For those of you that don't know me, I'm Terry Thornton. I'm Curator of Education, and I'm so happy you're here for Tuesday Evenings at the Modern, an ongoing lecture series that I'm somewhat sad to say is about a little more than halfway through. I think it's been a remarkable season. I think it's been kind of extraordinary in a program that's always good, so it's extra special. Next week, we continue with the writer and artist Greg Bordovitz presenting Testing Some Beliefs, which is an ongoing series of performances or lectures in which he considers the strength and longevity as well as present relevancy of some personal and collective beliefs. It's a moving presentation, as I saw it online on the website of the Gallery Mary Guy, where he had given a similar presentation. I believe what he does is he creates a matrix in which he gives these presentations, but each one is unique, so we'll get something unique. And I'm more than looking forward to seeing it in person right here in this auditorium at 7 p.m. next Tuesday, April 3rd. So be here or live with regret. I'm glad you're here tonight because I have similar feelings for tonight's presentation by writer and artist, or writer as artist, or artist as writer, Andrea Frazier. I'll let her straighten out those distinctions if she chooses to later. What I care about tonight is that she is here, and that she is here to present an essay that we discussed in 2006 when she came for another Tuesday Evenings at the Modern to present her ideas on art and its institutions as it pertained to her own work in performance, context art, and institutional critique, a term that, as I understand it, she is credited with coining. The said essay, "Why Does Fred Sandbach's Work Make Me Cry?" had been written in direct response to Andrea's personal viewing experience at the DIA Beacon and presented at the DIA for their Artist on Artist lectures. To my great fortune, I came to it out of a personal conversation on shared feelings for the work of Fred Sandbach, and in particular his show at the DIA in Chelsea in 1996, which we'd both seen. I believe she saw it as she worked there. Of course, it was the quality of that conversation and the depth of the essay that I later read that convinced me to, after an appropriate amount of time, ask Andrea to come back and give another lecture. I think I started extending the invitations about 2 years ago before finding a time in Andrea's very busy schedule. In fact, I believe she is sharing her spring break with us tonight. Shortly after being here in 2006, she was hired at UCLA as professor of new genres, and from what I have heard, her students appreciate the fact that they are very much the better for it. Andrea Frazier, being an exceptional teacher, comes as no surprise, being that she is a brilliant and passionate mind with a drive to share and exchange ideas. She has taught at various schools and universities throughout the years, including the Whitney Independent Study Program, that prestigious program that has launched the career of many an important artist, where she herself began and completed the program in 1985, and where she now serves as visiting faculty. She went on, of course, to have a very significant and meaningful career that has contributed greatly to the discourse of art. She was a founding member of the feminist performance group, the V-Girls, which was from 1986 to 96, the project-based artist initiative Parasite from 1997 to 1998, and the cooperative art gallery Orchard from 2005 to 2008. She was also a co-organizer with Helmut Draxler of services in working group exhibitions that toured to 8 venues in Europe and the United States between 1994 and 2001. Major projects of Andrea's have included installations for the Berkeley Art Museum, the Kunstverein in Munich, the Venice Biennale, and the Australian Pavilion, the Generali Foundation in Vienna, the Kunsthal Bern, and on, the Biennale of San Paolo, the Tate Modern, the accolades go on and on. As you might know, Andrea's essay, There Is No Place Like Home, is one of the catalog essays for the current Whitney Biennial, as well as functioning as a piece in the exhibition, complete with a wall text, as I understand it, that was written by Andrea Fraser. Survey exhibitions have included the Belkin Art Gallery, University of British Columbia, the Kunstverein in Hamburg, the Kemper Art Museum Washington University, the Franz Hals Museum in Harlem, and the Carpenter Center, Harvard University. And her text have appeared in significant publications that include Art in America, After Image, October, Social Text, Critical Quarterly Documents, Art Forum, and Gray Room, to name a few. Books include Andrea Fraser Works 1984 to 2003, published by Dumont, and Museum Highlights, the Writings of Andrea Fraser, which was released by MIT Press in 2005, and which we generally have on hand here. I don't know if you can find it right now in the bookstore, but we generally have that. And she has received grants from Art Matters, Inc., the Franklin Furness Fund for Performance Art, the New York Foundation for the Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. I am so very appreciative that she is here tonight, so please join me in welcoming Andrea Fraser.
Good evening. Thank you so much for coming this evening, and I have to thank Terry for inviting me a second time. It's really wonderful to be back. I was just very happy to be here in 2006, and found the audience just wonderful. So I'm sure it'd be wonderful.
I don't know.
What Terry's asked me to do this evening is not what I usually do when I come to give talks. It's not what I did last time. Last time when I was here in 2006, I talked about my work. Tonight, as Terry explained, she invited me to do something very specific, which is to read an essay that I wrote actually in 2004. And originally read in October, actually it says here on the first page of my manuscript, October 20, 25th, 2004, at the D'Art Foundation in New York, as part of a series they have where they invite contemporary artists, usually relatively young, but not always, to talk about work in their collection. And I subsequently also read this text at the Getty Museum, actually, in 2006 or 2007. And in fact, I haven't read it since then, aloud or to myself. And I decided not to read it prior to coming up here this evening because I wanted to see what would happen in the reading as I encountered this essay again. And I think I won't tell you too much more about it. And we'll see what happens. The essay is entitled, Why Does Fred Sandbach's Work Make Me Cry? ? The Greatest Generation. I first imagined this paper on the train ride home after my first visit to Dia Beacon in May 2003. I walked around the new museum's galleries that day with other Sunday visitors. It was a diverse group that appeared to include art students and art professionals, as well as families with strollers appearing bewildered, but behaving for the most part in respectful consideration of the art of our recently proclaimed greatest generation. I did what I always do when I visit new museums. I noted the relative sense of threshold in the entrance area and the different arrangements made for members and non-members, insiders and outsiders. I examined the wall labels. I appraised the didactics. I paced the location of the cafeteria and bookshop relative to the galleries. I measured the scale of the spaces with my body. I watched other visitors interact with the art as well as with the institution. I did all that. And I also looked at the art, more than I often do in museums, because much of the art in Dia's collections is actually art that I love. I love Saul Lewitt's work. At an exhibition in the University Art Museum in Berkeley not long ago, I found myself cooing over his small square photographs of stonework from the early 70s, like I was looking at baby pictures. I love Dan Flavin's work. I had the privilege of seeing Untitled 1970, then on view at Beacon, once before in Donald Judd's Soho building when I tagged along with a European dealer of mine for a private tour. I love Donald Judd's work too, although I preferred the installation of Untitled Slant Piece when I saw it at Paula Cooper Gallery a couple of years prior. I love Onkawara's work. I had never seen The Calendar on view in Beacon, and it was a revelation. I love Agnes Martin's work, although I would have liked to have seen more of her early work in that installation that day. I love Blinky Palermo's work. I worked as a gallery supervisor in Dia's 22nd Street building where I gave this talk when it first opened in the mid-1980s. And I spent months, literally months, sitting with Palermo's To the People of New York. That Sunday, it was like seeing old friends again. I love Robert Ryman's work. I stood and sat in the galleries with his paintings at Beacon for some time. They were quieter than many of the other galleries that day, and I could settle into the subtleties of the installation with only the occasional distraction of derisive comments from other visitors passing through. And I love Fred Sandbach's work, which I only really know from the 1996-97 show upstairs in Dia's Chelsea building. When I got to the galleries with the installation of his work at Beacon, I started to cry. I sat down on a bench there, and I wept. Why did Fred Sandbach's work make me cry? I began asking myself that question on the train ride home. I got the email address of Lynn Cook, then the chief curator of Dia, intending to ask her to give me an opportunity to explore that question in one of the lectures she organizes. But I got busy and I kept putting it off. Then I heard of Sandbach's suicide. I thought, I can't write about his work now, never having met him, when so many people are experiencing such a terrible personal loss, and when what I would write would probably be mostly about myself. In February 2004, however, out of the blue, Lynn Cook invited me to give a lecture at Dia Beacon. "Is there an artist in the collection you would like to write about?" she asked. "Well," I said, "actually, I had this idea, but I can't possibly do it now." But Lynn convinced me that it would be okay. So I wrote this text. The paper that I'll be reading tonight is a working through of my response to Fred Sandbach's work that day at Dia Beacon. It represents a kind of internal debate with myself about the positions that I've held on art and art museums, particularly as a practitioner of institutional critique. As such, it follows a rather personal course, both in terms of the intellectual underpinnings of my arguments and the feelings invested in them. I would like to apologize in advance to those of you who find those arguments unnecessarily arcane or extreme. Unfortunately for me, they are necessarily so. I also hope that those of you who knew Fred Sandbach will forgive me for seeking to identify with a man I never met, whose work is so very different from my own. Broken frames and water stains. My Sunday visit to Dia Beacon wasn't the first time I wept in an art museum, nor was it the last. The first time that I can recall was the first time that I visited the Louvre. It was 1985. I was 20 years old, in Europe for the first time, in Paris for an international Lacanian conference. It was a terrifying experience for a young high school dropout like myself, and the museum was something of a refuge from the lecture halls, an arena where I could feel just a little bit of competence, a little bit of legitimacy. As I walked around the museum, I thought, boy, did Walter Benjamin ever get it wrong when he wrote The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction. It was invariably the works of art that I had studied in reproduction that struck me with the greatest auratic force, like the Nike of Samothrace and Mona Lisa, of course, and Raphael's Virgin and Child with St. John the Baptist, which I had used in a little artist book a couple of years before, my first work of institutional critique. It was in front of that painting by Raphael that I started to cry. I was convinced that it wasn't the painting itself that made me weep, but the water stains on the wall next to it and the trash underneath it, left there by some of the hundreds of school children marched through the galleries that weekday afternoon. I had read Daniel Buren's The Function of the Museum. Museums abstract art from their social and historical contexts, withdrawing them from the world of material conflicts and needs and imposing an idealist ideology of timelessness under the rationale of conservation. It was so different than my experience of the Metropolitan Museum, a place I practically lived when I first moved to New York at 16, an idealized home away from home, always maintained in an immaculately pristine state, never a dust bunny in sight. A couple of years after that, back in Europe, I burst into tears in the galleries of the Kunsthistorisches Museum in Vienna. Again, I was convinced that it wasn't the art that made me weep. It wasn't that group of late Rembrandt self-portraits. It was their pre-restoration frames, dull and dusty and cracked in the corners. They were the materialization of the age and poverty worn on the represented faces, of the humanity reflected in the represented eyes. The frames provided those poor, passive pictures with a haven from the inhuman grandeur of the museum's imperial architecture, held them in their own history, not a history of masterpieces, but the history of lived life. They enacted a kind of resistance that the paintings themselves could not mount, being as they were so contained by that architecture and all that it represented. The waitress in the cafe on the museum's second floor, where I took refuge behind a massive marble column sobbing, had obviously seen this before. She sat me down and administered Vienna's other famous cure, a cup of hot chocolate and a piece of Sachertort. She wouldn't let me pay. The Stendhal syndrome? Were these experiences just instances of the so-called Stendhal syndrome, the phenomena of feeling overwhelmed by aesthetic beauty and old-world grandeur known particularly to affect Americans in their first encounters with the great cultural heritage of Europe? Also called tourism disease, the term Stendhal syndrome was reportedly coined in 1979 by the Florentine psychoanalyst Graziella Magrini to describe the symptoms she found to afflict many tourists in the city, in some cases even driving them into psychiatric wards. It was inspired by Stendhal's account of his 1817 visit to Santa Croce Cathedral, where he reported celestial sensations and feelings of ecstasy followed by heart palpitations, dizziness, and exhaustion. I wasn't able to find any clinical papers by Magrini on this phenomenon, although she did write a psychological thriller called The Stendhal Syndrome that was later made into a movie. I actually never tracked down the movie either. The symptoms I found listed include, in addition to dizziness and exhaustion, nausea, disorientation, panic, paranoia, and temporary amnesia. I found no mention of weeping. It's true that as I spent more time in Europe, these outbursts of mine became less frequent, the last one that I can recall being at the Alte Pinothek in Munich in 1993. Then about 5 years ago, I was visiting the Museum of Modern Art in New York and decided to walk through the permanent collection. I've been there before, of course, but I can admit that I don't actually go to museums all that often anymore. I don't go to museums for fun. I don't go to museums with much anticipation of pleasure. I go to museums, particularly in the United States, in a pretty defended state. In modern and pre-modern art museums, the ostensible object of that defense is mostly the institution. In contemporary museums or exhibitions, the object is more often the art on view. I hadn't visited the permanent collection at MoMA for some time, but both the art and the architecture were quite familiar to me. The walls and floors were clean. In the post-war section, there wasn't much in the way of frames. But when I entered the room with Barnett Newman's Vir Heroicus Sublimus, once again, I started to weep. I paused to get myself under control and continue on. But when I turned and saw an Ad Reinhardt black painting on an adjacent wall, I burst into tears again. It was that experience at MoMA that I recalled as I left Dia Beacon. In neither case did my emotion seem to be a response to a perceived pathos or grandeur in the context of the artwork, but rather to the works themselves. What could it be about this extremely reduced kind of art, so devoid of anything that would normally be considered expressive or affective, that caused me to weep? The disappointed eye. Encounters with art are among the occasions for tears described in the psychoanalytic literature on weeping. Under a subheading, Weeping for Unclear Reasons, Mood, etc., Lars Lofgren includes being moved to tears by scenes of unusual scenic beauty, certain types of music, usually described as serene, spiritual, or tragic, certain films, and, although evidently less often, other types of pictorial art. Other situations of weeping, he lists, include frustrating encounters with persons and things and bodily pain, object loss, shame and humiliation, weddings, mother and child in tender situations, and the sweet innocence of budding love. Weeping, when compassion and empathy are stirred by observing the misfortunes and sufferings of others, especially when these visitations appear undeserved, tears of impotent rage. I would like to know what omnipotent rage would be. I mean, actually, I can imagine omnipotent rage, but I can't associate it. Weeping in situations of danger leading to fear, and pathological weeping, a term he borrows from Phyllis Greenacre to describe situations where weeping is outside the grasp of the observer's empathy or sympathy and seems alien or nearly so to the weeping person himself. So I imagine my weeping must have appeared to many other visitors at Dia Beacon that Sunday, if they could even conceive that my tears might be related to the art on display. Of course, the most common occasion of weeping, as Greenacre notes in her essay on the development and function of tears, is loss. In this category, Greenacre includes the loss by death or alienation of someone to whom the weeper has been closely attached, or the loss of some material object, or the withdrawal of something promised, or the loss of a body part or possession, or even, and not infrequently, the loss of esteem for a friend or of self-esteem, resulting then in a diminished self-image. Lofgren shows that many situations of weeping that appear remote from separation and its associated sadness are in fact connected to early object loss. For example, object loss can be found to underlie most experiences of apparently joyful weeping, like at weddings or at happy endings, which may remind us of a lost happy past or of a past made unhappy due to loss. Separation and object loss also relate to the early communicative function of weeping, as Wood and Wood point out in another paper, particularly when tears are accompanied by a cry. Whether occasioned by pain, frustration, deprivation, anger, or simply separation itself, a child's cry is often a call for an absent mother and for the anticipated relief to be provided with her presence. Writing in a very different context, Jacques Lacan linked the infant's cry with the earliest of demands. Quote, a demand of a presence or of an absence that constitutes the other as already possessing the privilege of satisfying needs, that is to say, the power of depriving them of that alone by which they are satisfied. For Lacan, the cry is primarily linguistic. However, as other authors have pointed out, one can cry without tears and shed tears without crying. Weeping includes both. In On the Development and Function of Tears, Greenacre is concerned with the specificity of weeping. Weeping, she reminds us, is an affair of the eye. So she asks, what is the relationship of weeping to looking and to seeing, or to looking and not seeing? She turns to the situation of mourning. The bereaved person may find himself actually expecting to see the lost loved one and will accordingly be startled by seeming resemblances in strangers. This begins very much as in the child who weeps when left by the mother. The weeper weeps because he does not see the person or the object which he has lost, and must gradually accept the fact that his... The weeper weeps because he does not see the person or the object which he has lost, and must gradually accept the fact that his looking is in vain. The eye is the most important sensory object in establishing a loss. And so, what she calls the disappointed eye, failing to find the lost object, behaves very much like the traumatized eye, which defends itself with a soothing tear, caring for itself, perhaps, as it longs to be cared for by the absent other. The shadow of the object. Object loss in psychoanalytic theory is an extremely complex phenomenon, and one that doesn't only give rise to feelings of sadness and longing. Greenacre reminds us of the ambivalence that Freud discovered within every experience of object loss, real or fantasied. Quote, the first reaction may be one of anger and the wish to attack either the person who has gone away, deserted, or someone who is blamed for the loss, or the self in some way, either actually or in feeling, being responsible for it. Close quote. Psychoanalysts have found such ambivalence to underlie depressive states, as well as mourning and melancholia. In the case of melancholia, the subject identifies with the lost object and thus directs against itself the anger, criticism, and aggressivity attached to that object, but denied out of guilt or an inability to accept loss. Freud described this condition in his essay on mourning and melancholia. Quote, and this is pretty dense, the object cathexis, or an investment, emotional investment, proved to have little power of resistance and was abandoned. But the free libido was withdrawn into the ego and not directed at another object. It did not find application there, however, but served simply to establish an identification of the ego with the abandoned object. Thus, the shadow of the object fell upon the ego, so that the latter could henceforth be criticized by a special mental faculty like an object, like the forsaken object. In this way, the loss of the object became transformed into a loss in the ego, and the conflict between the ego and the loved person transformed into a cleavage between the criticizing faculty of the ego and the ego as altered by identification. In his paper on weeping, it is in relationship to this ambivalence above all that Lofgren finds the function of weeping. Tears, he notes, are the only human excretion almost universally regarded as clean. We speak of being bathed in tears, washed with tears. Tears not only represent affective discharge and emotional relief, but also a kind of cleansing, a purification of feeling, and particularly, Lofgren argues, of aggressivity. Weeping is, quote, an act whereby aggressive energy is dissipated in secretory behavior instead of being discharged on an object as an attack. In this way, he argues, weeping may serve as a way of avoiding the guilt connected to aggressivity, as well as allowing for a purer expression of love and therefore perhaps a truer experience of loss. The location of aesthetic experience. What kind of aesthetic experience can be admitted by a hardcore, uncompromising, materialist, sociologically informed institutional critic like myself? The difficulty I have may be less with the experience, or having it, than with locating that experience in anything that might be considered imminent in a work of art, particularly in its formal aspects. At Dia Beacon one Sunday, I encountered works of art composed of lengths of colored acrylic yarn strung from floor to ceiling or floor to wall. It's art that I love, and when I encountered it, I wept. I can describe Fred Sandbach's work as beautiful. I can talk about the way it brings space alive by creating shimmering virtual planes. I can talk about the way it makes me hum in a kind of empathy with the visual vibrations created by the yarn. I can talk about the feeling of calmness brought on by the very precise perceptual focus his work requires. But why would those things make me weep? Sandbach's work is an art of absences, an art that's only just barely there to be seen. I could talk about the disappointed eye longing to see what is not there to be seen, the eye traumatized by loss, soothing itself with tears. But would such an experience be an aesthetic experience? And why would I find loss or memory of loss in those visual voids? Against what kind of presence would they even exist for me as voids? I am speaking about an art with a rigorously purified formal vocabulary. Could there be an identification of formal purification with affective, emotional purification, of the washing away of an excess of form and the washing away of an excess of feeling, of aggressive feeling? Could it be that when I encountered Sandbach's work, I was able to discharge in the form of tears some of the hostility to art institutions, perhaps even to art itself, that turned me into an institutional critic in the first place? This may be closest to the truth. But here, once again, I have left the realm of aesthetic form and returned to the institutional frame. the criticizing faculty. As a student of the French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu, not directly, but of his work, I have long been convinced that the disposition to seek aesthetic experiences with works of art or in the institutions that house them, as well as the capacity to have such experiences, are socially determined. They depend on competencies acquired either through implicit learning of exposure to art at home or the more explicit learning in educational and cultural institutions, a learning which in turn generally requires a disposition to recognize and accept the legitimacy of those institutions and aspire to the capacities they demand and experiences they offer. I've been convinced of this by my own experience as well as Bourdieu's research and analysis. However, this conviction also includes an element of ethical decision. The alternatives are just too politically problematic for me to consider. The idea that some of us are born with a greater sensitivity to beauty, or a greater ability to perceive form, or a greater capacity to be moved by color and line, can never be anything other than a figment of what Bourdieu once called the self-legitimizing imagination of the happy few, one of those essentialist ideologies deployed by the culturally and generally also economically privileged in order to convince themselves and others of their entitlement. And if the capacity for aesthetic experience is socially determined, so must be its relationship to the objects and situations with which those experiences are had. That is to say, those experiences can be no more imminent in the objects than they are in persons. If some objects are more pleasing, more moving, more evocative, or even provocative than others to some people, it is not due to any innate characteristic of those objects, which certain people are more innately in tune to than others. It is due rather to the fact that the capacity to perceive and recognize, as well as the disposition to appreciate particular forms aesthetically, was developed alongside the capacity to produce those forms, so much so that in the history of modernism, they became almost the same thing. As Bourdieu wrote, modern art began to demand, quote, categorically an attention to form, which previous art only demanded conditionally, close quote. Modern art began, in effect, to require the viewer to reproduce in his or her own perception of the work the primary operation whereby the work itself was produced. Increasingly, as artists rejected the particular crafts that historically defined artistic competence, a process that has been called de-skilling and associated strongly with minimalism, the primary operation of aesthetic production became almost inseparable from an operation of aesthetic perception, of perceiving a form or an object aesthetically. The work of art became, in a sense, the objectification of that aesthetic perception in an increasingly purified form. A definition of art that might be derived from Bourdieu's work could be summarized as follows. Something is art if it exists for discourses and practices that recognize and can appropriate it as art. Thus, sociologically speaking, art cannot exist outside of the field of art, outside of the field of the discourses and practices in which art can be recognized as art. The institution of art is not something external to any work of art, but the absolute and irreducible condition of its existence. The museum is not a mechanism for the institutionalization of art. The museum is an institutional form of art, of aesthetic perception and of aesthetic practice. The museum is art made institution. Public art, to the extent that it demands to be perceived as art, whether through its own internal formal characteristics or accompanying publicity and didactics, does not leave the institution of art. It carries that institution with it out into the streets and parks and public squares. So-called outsider art, popular and vernacular culture, may indeed originate outside of the field of art, but as soon as it enters the artistic field, not only physically in museum displays, but also discursively as the object of aesthetic recognition and perception, it ceases to be outside. Far from challenging the boundaries of art and the hierarchies of culture, however, their incorporation serves rather to expand and empower them. What constitutes this elite or high, in quotes, aesthetic culture are not only rarefied objects and works, but also the modes of appropriation and perception of those works, which in turn depend on rarefied and socially valorized dispositions and competencies. And those dispositions and competencies are embodied by individuals no less than by objects. Their internalization constitutes what Bourdieu called habitus, the social made body, the social made flesh, institutional bodies. We are all here members of the artistic field. We carry, each of us, this institution inside ourselves. There's a museum here inside of me, with the Corinthian columns, the grand staircase, and the mezzanine. There's a system of organization, the way I see things. There are objects and images, and there are texts, and there are voices explaining. There's an archive that also contains our memories, and there's a basement where we keep the things we don't want to show. Just as art cannot exist outside of the field of art, I cannot exist outside of the field of art, at least not as an artist. And this is also the limit of institutional critique. I can attack those internal objects. I can rip at the walls of my institutional body, but I can't tear it down completely, and I can't leave it, because then I would not only cease to have an effect within the field, I would also cease to exist. Institutional critique has the structure of melancholia. Remember my quote from Mourning and Melancholia from Freud. Quote, thus the shadow of the object fell upon the ego, so that the latter could henceforth be criticized by a special mental faculty, like an object, like the forsaken object, close quote. I exist in the shadow of these internalized objects, the institution, first of all, and its voices that speak through me, works of art, through the eyes of which I see. To transpose the Freudian scheme, the conflict between myself and these internalized objects, which are also loved and forsaken objects, is transformed into a splitting between a criticizing faculty and myself as I have been altered by my identification with them. But what is the love and what is the loved and forsaken object here? This is my greatest difficulty. I believe that art cannot exist outside of the field of art. However, at the same time, as I maintain this view, I know that somehow I also believe that art cannot exist within the field of art. It must be art in this sense that is lost for me. But what could this art be? This art that can't exist within the field of art, the only place that art can exist. I'm afraid of this question. I'm afraid of its metaphysics. I'm afraid of the irreducibility of the loss that it leads to. I'm afraid of the lure of essentialism that leads away from that loss. How can I account for it? In two monumental sentences, in his book Distinction, A Social Critique of the Judgment of Taste, Bourdieu describes, quote, the difference between the legitimate culture of class societies and the culture of little differentiated or undifferentiated societies. In class societies, the appropriation of cultural products presupposes dispositions and competencies which are not distributed universally, although they have the appearance of innateness. As a consequence, these products are subject to exclusive appropriation, material or symbolic, and thus come to function as cultural capital, existing as products of domination predisposed to express or legitimate domination. In societies with little or no class differentiation, on the other hand, access to the means of appropriation of the cultural heritage is fairly equally distributed, so that culture is fairly equally mastered by all members of the group and cannot function as cultural capital, i.e., as an instrument of domination, or only so within very narrow limits and with a very high degree of euphemization. The boundaries of the artistic field not only mark but continually reproduce an originary split that is also an originary loss. This is first of all the splitting that is the social differentiation and hierarchization. It is the splitting of the social world into classes and with divisions of labor into specialized fields of production. It is the splitting off of art as an autonomous field from the field of general culture. It is the splitting off of artists as specialized producers of culture and of competencies that are unequally mastered and cultural goods that are unequally shared. This lost world of shared culture and competence may be no more than a kind of anthropological fantasy, our very own myth of origins. However, I think it is what serves as a lost object for many artists and for much art today. It is the idyllic primal state of culture we want to imagine once prevailed before the expulsion, when we were driven out of the world of into the world of specialization, hierarchical divisions of labor and competence, and competitive struggles for recognition and reward. I can recognize it as the lost object of my own work, and I perceive a longing for it too in what Fred Sandbach called pedestrian space, literal, flat-footed, and everyday, where the work of art exists, quote, right there along with everything else in the world, not up on a spatial pedestal. It was an idea, he wrote, full of utopian glimmerings of art and life happily cohabiting. Worlds in ruin. So this is my problem. I don't believe that art can exist outside the field of art, but I also don't believe that art can exist within the field of art. For me, art is an impossibility. And if art is impossible, then artists are also impossible, and I myself am impossible. To the extent that I exist, I can only exist as a compromise, a travesty, a fiction, a fraud. The only integrity I can hope to recover is by trying to make sure I'm never misrecognized for anything else. Hannah Siegel, I think, was the first to apply Melanie Klein's theory of the depressive position, what Klein called melancholia in statu nascendi, to art in a 1952 essay entitled A Psychoanalytical Approach to Aesthetics. Klein argued that the work of art is like the work of mourning, a process of working through melancholic guilt and anxieties associated with real and fantasied loss through efforts at repairing, reestablishing, or recreating lost objects of love. The melancholic takes refuge from the anxiety of loss in a kind of defensive splitting that Freud wrote about in Mourning and Melancholia, splitting not only the lost object into good and bad, idealized and despised parts, but splitting herself as well into good and bad, loving and hating parts, corresponding to her own ambivalence. The resulting battle that rages inside the subject only increases guilt and anxiety, however, and leaves the internal world of the melancholic in ruins. The work of mourning is to put that world back together again. Siegel writes that all creation is really a recreation of a once loved and once whole but now lost and ruined object, a ruined internal world and self. It is when the world within us is destroyed, when it is dead and loveless, when our loved ones are in fragments, and we ourselves in helpless despair, it is then that we must recreate our world anew, reassemble the pieces, infuse life into dead fragments, recreate life.